The new book, Fear of Black Consciousness, is a journey through the historical development of racialized blackness, the problems this kind of consciousness produces, and the many creative responses from black and non-black communities in contemporary struggles for dignity and freedom. Lewis R. Gordon is an Afro-Jewish philosopher, political thinker, educator, and musician. He is professor and head of the philosophy department at UConn Storrs. In the book, he exposes the bad faith at the heart of many discussions about race and racism, not only in America, but across the globe, including those who think of themselves as colorblind. The name of the new book is Fear of Black Consciousness by Lewis Gordon, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Very nice to have you on the show. Give us a sense of what brought you to the topic and wanting to look at this.
Well, this is a topic I've been looking at in various ways throughout my career. My first book was Bad Faith and Anti-Black Racism, where I talked about bad faith, and I talk about racism as a form of bad faith. But over the years, I found that this is a recurring theme, not only in the United States, but across the globe. I was asked 24 years ago to write this book, actually, but the editor who invited me then moved to Pharaoh Strauss Hero, and he contacted me 20 years later and said, did you write that book? And I was doing so many other things since then. And I'm so happy I did not write the book 20 years ago, because since then I've spoken all over the globe and learned quite a bit about different languages, different communities, and how they live these issues. And as I got to experience the common humanity of us all, it made it so clear to me that the basic argument was right, but I needed at this point to connect it in a way that would be relevant for our times. And unfortunately, it is relevant for our times because we continue to try to evade reality. So if for the listeners, just a very brief thing, the fear of black consciousness is a fear of truth and reality.
So Jesse McCarthy writes in the Los Angeles Review of Books, while Gordon did not coin the term anti-black and anti-blackness, he was the first to theorize and to use it in a rigorous and systemic way. So following up on what you just said, let us start with those definitions of anti-black and anti-blackness.
Sure. Well, anti-black is very straightforward. It's if you don't like things that are black. But we're talking about racialized blackness. And one of the strange things about racialized blackness is that one has to find a human being and then designate the human being black and then claim that by virtue of that blackness, that human being is not fully a human being. But it gets even further. What I argue is that there's a tendency to lie to ourselves. That's what I mean by bad faith, by the way. It's when we try to avoid a displeasing truth through leaping into the arms of a pleasing falsehood. The displeasing truth is that a lot of the terrible things that have been done over the past several hundred years have been done to human beings. The pleasing falsehood is that they're not really human beings. And to help us with such lies, we often try to create a world that will support those lies. And I didn't coin the term anti-black, but or even the term anti-black racism. But what I do talk about is the project of trying to create an anti-black world. In other words, the effort to make that hatred global. Now, one of the things is that even though I say hatred here, it's not always about hate. There is a kind of fetishizing or exoticizing of black people that also hides our humanity. And all racisms, whether it's about black people, East Asian people, indigenous peoples, all racisms are about ultimately the denying of the humanity of another human being, which means, although there are people who vehemently argue against it, racism can actually be structured against anybody, against any group, as long as there's a system of power to dehumanize them.
You talk about a lot of things in this book, and you bring us to current events such as the pandemic and the George Floyd protests, the Capitol riot. But let us use the pandemic as an example to illustrate some of what you are talking about and how anti-blackness fits into that.
Sure. What I argue is that if we did not have the organization of our institutions, the organization of power devoted to producing vulnerability, to radicalizing inequality, to creating people whose lives are precarious, uncertain, always in doubt, if we didn't do those things, then something like a virus, something like many viruses, bacteria, other things that preceded this, you know, if we go all the way back to smallpox, would just be isolated events. But if we design our society in such a way that it is a fine-tuned system to work towards genocide, dehumanization, inequality, poverty, etc., then we'll have the catastrophic effects that we're having right now with the COVID-19 pandemic. And this is because pandemics are not exclusively biological. Pandemics are also social. And what we have right now is a social illness. We have a situation in which we are actually trying to find ways to make people go through extraordinary suffering for the sake of profit and privatization. Right now, we have all the means to deal with this virus and a lot of other problems. We have all the means to deal with economic problems, climate change, the list is long. But we're committed to a way of organizing power in our world that actually exacerbates these problems and in some cases create them.
So when you see a poll or a study that indicates that there is distrust in a vaccine, there's distrust in the government when it comes to the pandemic and getting a full range of shots of whatever that means at any given time by the CDC. How do you read that? What do you make of that?
I see that as a consequence of misinformation, disinformation, for the sake of what is aptly called lawfare. Lawfare is a technique that replaces ordinary mechanisms of war, such as, you know, guns and bombs, by bringing those techniques into the society at an everyday level. Many people who are refusing vaccines have already received 50 other vaccines, some of which are not as effective as these vaccines. But as we know, one of the surest ways to make somebody make a stupid decision is to say to the person that there are other people who think they're stupid if they make the right decision.
Right.
And these are old techniques. They're part of not only of psychology, but they're also just part of mechanisms that are used in politics that go back more than 100 years. And so, in effect, what we're seeing right now is that people right now are being pushed, encouraged, manipulated into looking at our fellow human being as exclusively friend or enemy, without seeing properly that we're all in this together, and that it's not only about what my actions do to me, it's about what my action does to others. And beyond that, the realization that we human beings don't live in a world by ourselves. We live in a human world. And a human world is a creative, ongoing, changing world. But it is also a world of profound vulnerability, because it requires us working together, communicating, understanding, for it to work. But as we know, there are people who can profit from dysfunction. And this is part of the situation today. There are people profiting from death.
That idea that you just posited, I mean, it's when you talk about, this isn't a black-white issue, this is a human issue. We are polarized politically. We are polarized on many issues of from the simplest things in our communities of one side against another on, you know, putting up a fence in the ballpark. So how do we get around that ultimately can change our entire infrastructure, if you will, to allow us to remove these stigmas that so many of us have?
Well, to begin with, we need to think outside of the box. One of the ways in which these problems have occurred has been through the imposition of narrow-minded thinking. There are so many false things at an everyday level that people believe. People believe they could be an individual who govern their lives by themselves. People believe that there are such things as people who are born intrinsically superior and people who are born intrinsically inferior. Many people believe that somehow they are entitled to have everything. But the reality is that we live in a world in which ultimately some of the things we try to push at a distance, like blackness, are actually things or people or relationships that are connected more to reality. So one of the things, I usually compare this to being a child in the bedroom at night when you think there's a monster in your room.
Right.
What's amusing is, of course, children often go under the blanket. And what is the monster supposed to do? It's as if the logic is the monster says, oh my goodness, there goes that blanket again. What am I going to do? I got to wait now for the child to move the blanket. But of course, the child deep down knows that a blanket cannot protect you from a monster. The blanket is a metaphor for a willingness not to face reality. So a step forward is for us to begin to face reality. And reality is not only about science. Science is an important part of reality. Science talks about evidence, etc. But also reality is about our abilities to see, really to see each other, and to understand how we build institutions together, that ultimately it's going to have to be up to us to build the world we need to live in. And some people may say that really that's a large undertaking. But you know, a lot of the good things we have in the world today were things that people in the past said were impossible to achieve. You'll always find naysayers. There'll always be people who say it cannot be done. But the people who tend to say it cannot be done usually give the bad argument, which is because we tried it and it didn't work. But it may have been because you tried it under different conditions. What we need to do today is to start setting the foundations of building the conditions for us to be able to do something about these problems. And part of that is to be truthful about the lives of people and how they're affected. If we think about Black lives, for instance, there's a tendency to treat Black lives, and when I say Black, I don't mean exclusively African-American or people who are from Africa. anybody can actually be made into black. And I talk about varieties of people, whether they're going to be the untouchables of India or it's going to be indigenous Australian peoples. The list is long. But the main thing that we have to bear in mind is that we do not deal with the people and what they have to offer if we make the people into problems. We need to understand that we need to look at human beings as people who face problems. And that means we can address those problems in a way that could give people the options to make meaningful and hopefully intelligent decisions. People don't always make the best decisions. But if we structure our society in a very intelligent way, we don't have to rely on the worst decision makers, because the better decision makers are in a situation where it can come down to the everyday person, such as you, me, our mother, father, brother, sister, etc.
You put that so beautifully, and I think about it, and it's percolating in my brain. And my smart-ass response to it immediately is, okay, but intelligence is really hard to find sometimes. So how do we do that? And because you also write beautifully in this book about invisibility. And you mentioned this in just the last answer about opening our eyes and seeing and really taking that blanket off and realizing that either looking the monster in the eye or realizing that there is no monster at all. So how do we figure that out and come together and become a more intelligent people on these very issues that you and I are discussing on this Thursday morning?
Well, to begin with, we need to break our idols of what we think intelligence is. Too often, we construct intelligence through models of perfection, models of gods, models of notions of those who are superior and those who are inferior. Those are all problematic.
I see you as intelligent.
Yes, but the thing is, when I think about intelligence, I don't think about myself as an intrinsic person who is endowed with an immediate gift to know the world better than others. What I see intelligence as is a form of humility in which one approaches life as a student. I often, when I teach my classes, formulate a professor as a person who fell in love with learning, mm-hmm. and continue to learn. So even when I'm writing books, for me, I write them as a student, and I'm sharing with fellow students. I see humankind as a community of students working together to learn. And one of the things, if we break those idols, we begin to understand that intelligence is about a form of reasonability that does not erase the affective or passionate life of our humanity. For things to be meaningful, we have to be able to live them. We have to be able to share them, enjoy them. We need to also be able to understand them, and we also need to understand what it is to look at our fellow human being with her, his, or their imperfections. And when we think that way, we understand that when we work together, it's not that we overnight willy-nilly get all the answers, but our working together build parts of the answers that subsequent generations or people in other places can contribute to. Hmm. And as we work together, the reflection from the future would be the gift of thanks. In other words, if we refuse to work together, if we refuse to do the kind of learning practices that make us look at different ways in which we can build a better world, the subsequent generation would be saying, why didn't they act properly? Why are we going through this? So with humility, with communication, with also taking seriously that political action works. The fact of the matter is, we are able to be in a world today where I could talk with you, you could talk with me, and there are so many people who could speak with each other and work together who just a short time ago, even in my childhood, were informed that it would be impossible for them to work together. So within our efforts, we must always make it clear through our actions and our deed what is possible and also what is appreciated, because ultimately it makes the lives of all better.
What I love about what you just said is that we don't have to solve everything overnight. We can work together on parts of the problem, and we can work together one step at a time. And it is a step at a time. And we often think that we have to snap our fingers and change everything. But not only is that not realistic, it just makes more sense to say, okay, I can look at this and we can take a part of it.
Absolutely. In fact, what's the point of talking about reality if one doesn't actually address what really goes on when we act? I often say the best way to climb a mountain is not through looking at the top of the mountain, but pay attention to the steps along the way. And too often, there are people who are looking for the outcome before the performance. And sometimes you may have intended to go up to the top of a mountain, but the steps along the way make you see something that's very beautiful and appreciated at different levels, different stages. And some people may decide they got to get to the top of the mountain no matter what. But some people may discover a beautiful garden along the way and say, you know what? I like it here. Mm. Or some may find sparkling spring water. And in other cases, someone at the top of the mountain may find that he, she, or they are at the top of the mountain alone, and it was a very shallow enterprise. So along the way, there are many things for us to learn, but we need to be open. We need to understand that life is always more than we think it is. And it's up to us, at least, to grow and relate to it in a way that makes each action something that's a lot more beautiful, a lot more shared, and at the end of the day, meaningful. And, you know, when we think about success, you know, I often say to people, you know, I don't have to work with somebody who had the greatest success in the world. I'd like to work with somebody who what she, he, or they commit themselves to will do it. So even if that person has small successes, that person is reliable. And this is the thing we miss. We keep looking for the big payoff when we fail to understand that humanity is still here today because, you know, our species almost went extinct,
right?
A relatively short time ago, because of all those people who did those small actions, many of whom we don't know, they're anonymous, they're gone. But those actions, those people's actions matter, and or rather mattered. And there are a lot of people today who think what they do don't matter, but there's a lot to come, and we don't know whose actions will make the difference. But we know those actions need to be done.
Lewis Gordon is our guest, and the book is Fear of Black Consciousness. The first, we only have about 2 minutes left, but which I could talk to you for a lot longer. But let me just end with this, which is just helping me try to feel better about myself. Please tell me that the first word of your title is fear. I mean, are there times where you still feel that fear that you want to put a blanket over your head?
I'm a human being like all other human beings, and there are times I do feel that way. But part of a life devoted to studying these issues make me become self-critical. And I understand that I need to get up and turn on the light.
And that's basically what we all have to do, is get up and turn on the light.
Correct.
The book is beautiful. You are amazing. It is Lewis R. Gordon is the author of Fear of Black Consciousness. It is just out. It is from FSG. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. It's a great privilege and pleasure to have you on our program and sharing with our audience this morning.
Thank you so much. And to you and to the audience, continue being safe, healthy, and I wish you love and, despite the difficult times, joy. Joy will remind you of your humanity.
And I return that to you as well. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.